before. Why don't I just start reading from there? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
You got it? Okay, great. Samaraj Prabhu Ki Jai. No, no problem. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 45, chapter, it's entitled Krishna Rescues His Teacher's Son. And today we're covering text 1. First we'll read the chapter summary. This chapter describes how Lord Krishna consoled Devaki, Vasudev, and Nanda Maharaj and installed Ugrasena as king. It also relates how Krishna and Balaram completed their education, retrieved the dead son of their guru, and then returned home. Noting that his parents, Vasudev and Devaki, had realized his true position as God, Sri Krishna expanded his yoga maya to again make them think of him as their dear child. Then, with Lord Balaram, Krishna approached them and said how unhappy he was that he and they were unable to enjoy the mutual satisfaction of parents and children who lived together. Then he stated, even in a lifetime of 100 years, no son can ever repay the debt he owes his parents, from whom he receives his very body. Any capable son who fails to support his parents will be forced in the hereafter to eat his own flesh. Did you hear that play? No. Am I kidding? Indeed, any person who does not maintain and nourish those under his care, children, wife, spiritual masters, brahmanas, elderly parents, and so on, is simply a living corpse. It is out of fear of Kamsa that we could not serve you. So now, please forgive us. Vasudeva and Devaki, overcome with emotion upon hearing these words of Sri Krishna's, embraced their two sons, and in ecstasy shed a torrent of tears. Having thus satisfied his mother and father, Lord Krishna offered Kamsa's kingdom to his maternal grandfather, Ugrasena, and then arranged for his family members, all his family members who had fled in fear of Kamsa, to return to their homes. Protected by the almighty arms of Krishna and Balaram, the Yadavas began to enjoy supreme bliss. Krishna and Balaram next approached Nanda Maharaj and praised him for having cared so lovingly for them, another's sons. Krishna then said to Nanda, dear father, please return to Braj, knowing how much you and our other relatives are suffering in separation from us. Balaram and I will come to see you as soon as we have satisfied your friends here in Mathura. Krishna then worshipped Nanda with various offerings, and Nanda felt overwhelmed with love for his sons. After tearfully embracing Krishna and Balaram, he took the cowherd men and departed for Braj. Next, Vasudev had his priest perform his son's ritual of second birth, Brahminical initiation. Krishna and Balaram then went to Garga Muni to take the vow of Brahmacharya, celibacy. Afterward, Krishna and Balaram, though omniscient, desired to reside at the school of his spiritual master, and thus they went to live with Sandipani Muni at Avantipur, which is in the district of Ujjain. To teach the proper way to respect one's guru, Krishna and Balaram served their spiritual master with great devotion, as they would a deity of the Supreme Lord himself. Sandipani Muni, pleased by their service, imparted to them detailed knowledge of all the Vedas, together with their six corollaries and the Upanishads. Krishna and Balaram needed to hear each subject explained only once to assimilate it completely. And thus, in 64 days, they learned the 64 traditional arts. Before taking leave of their guru, the two lords offered Sandipani Muni any gift he desired. The wise Sandipani, seeing their amazing prowess, requested that they bring back his son, who had died in the ocean at Prabhas. Krishna and Balaram mounted a chariot and went to Prabhas, where they approached the shore and worshipped the presiding deity of the ocean. Krishna asked the ocean to return his spiritual master's son, and the lord of the ocean replied that a demon dwelling within the ocean named Panchajana had taken the boy away. Hearing this, Sri Krishna entered the ocean, killed that demon, and took the shell that had grown from his body. But when Krishna did not find his guru's son within the demon's belly, he went to the planet of Yamaraj, the lord of death. Yamaraj came forward when he heard Krishna blow the Panchajanya conch shell and devotedly worshipped him. Lord Krishna then asked Yamaraj for Sanipani Muni's son, and Yamaraj immediately gave him to the two lords. Krishna and Balaram then returned to their spiritual master and presented him with his son, requesting him to choose yet another favor. But Sanipani Muni replied that by having obtained disciples such as them, all his desires were fulfilled. He thus instructed them to return home. Krishna and Balaram traveled to their home by chariot, and upon their arrival, all the citizens became unlimitedly ecstatic to see them, just like persons who have regained a lost treasure. Okay, so we'll go through this pretty quickly because it's... do we do responsively or...
One verse.
Huh?
Do one verse responsively.
One person response, one verse response. I'm just doing one verse today. Yeah, maybe we just do that because it's I bit off a lot to chew in the class today, so there's not so much time. So just we can just chant this in unison, not responsively. Sri Sukha Uvacha Pitaravupalam Dharto Vitiva Purushottama Maburiti Nijamayam Tatana Janamohinam. Translation, Sukadeva Goswami said, understanding that his parents were becoming aware of his transcendental opulences, the Supreme Personality of Godhead thought that this should not be allowed to happen. He expanded his yoga maya, which bewilders his devotees. Purport. If Vasudeva and Devaki would have seen Krishna as Almighty God, their intense love for him as her son would have been spoiled. Lord Krishna did not want this. Rather, the Lord wanted to enjoy with them the ecstatic love of Vatsalya Ras, the relationship between parents and children. As Srila Prabhupada often pointed out, although we normally think of God as the Supreme Father, in Krishna consciousness we can enter into the Lord's pastimes and play the part of his parents, thus intensifying our love for him. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out that the word jana may be translated here as devotees, as in the verse, diyamanam na grinanti vina mat sevanam jana. He further explains that jana may also be translated as parents, since jana is derived from the word jan, which in a causative form, janayate, means to generate or to give birth to. In this sense of the word, as in Janani or Janako, the term Jana Mohini indicates that the Lord was about to expand his internal illusory potency so that Vasudeva and Devaki would again love him as their dear child. So translation again. Sukadeva Goswami said, understanding that his parents were becoming aware of his transcendental opulences, the Supreme Personality of God had thought that this should not be allowed to happen. Thus he expanded his yoga maya, which bewilders his devotees. Om Aganata Marandasha Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Umlikam Gena Tajmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, Nanda Mataji was very kind and asked me to give class in place of her. So I'm begging for the Vaishnava's mercy that I can say something of value the many senior devotees here. So please be merciful upon me and allow me to speak something of value. In the purport, the sentence that kind of stood out for me and which inspired me to expand the class on was the last sentence of the first paragraph. As Srila Prabhupada often pointed out, although we normally think of God as the Supreme Father and Krishna consciousness, we can enter into the Lord's pastimes and play the part of his parents. Okay, so in Krishna consciousness, you can do that, thus intensifying our love for him. So I'm kind of a practical person. So what I started thinking, well, how do you do this? If this is actually something that's vastly superior, then, you know, obviously devotees should make an attempt to, you know, develop this type of relationship with Krishna. So in the Adi Leela, chapter 4, text 15 and 16, there's a description. This is the chapter that's entitled The Confidential Reasons for Lord Chaitanya's Appearance. And so I don't know the shloka. It's not so commonly recited, but essentially the translation is that the Lord comes to relish the different mellows of devotional service and to propagate spontaneous devotion throughout the world. So this is actually the mission of Lord Chaitanya. And interestingly enough, in the preceding verses and purports, there's a description that the killing of Kamsa, which we've just completed, is kind of an incidental activity. And actually, Krishna himself didn't do it. It was done by Vishnu that came along with Lord Krishna when he appeared, as well as all of the other expansions and plenary and partial plenary expansions. Then the reason is that Vishnu's role is to protect and maintain the universe. So that was his job. Now, don't ask me to explain how that actually took place, because at least in the Leela, it appears that Krishna's doing it, but it's actually Vishnu that's doing it. So what really, Lord Krishna descended for, very similar, to demonstrate this Braj Bhakti. And then this is what, of course, Lord Chaitanya came to spread it throughout the world. So even though we may be engaged in Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, the real purpose of the Hare Krishna movement and of Lord Chaitanya's coming to this planet and Prabhupada's preaching was to spread spontaneous devotion throughout the world. So that may seem like maybe Janmashtami Das is deviating or something, or trying to, start a Prakriti Sahaja cult or something like that. But this is the tattva, is very prominent in our tradition. Now, when Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, when Bhaktivinoda Thakur started his preaching, Gaudiya Vaishnavism had kind of degraded, in practice, so that most of the people that were so-called Gaudiya Vaishnavas were Prakriti Sahajiyas. So Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur in particular was, described as a Singha Guru. This was a big part of his mission to put a stop to this. So that it's not that like Upadesharan, you know, the text 8 of Upadeshamrita. You know, this is the essence of all instructions, you know, to practice Raghunuga Bhakti. So Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada, they were very strong that one should not prematurely practice this, because as Prabhupada would say, that rather than becoming purified, one will become putrefied by this. You know, in other words, it'll be a source of degradation if one, you know, out of pratishta, a desire for recognition, you know, goes through, you know, this, the Raghunuga Bhakti Sadhana, then, you know, rather than becoming elevated, he'll just be meditating in a lusty way, which is what was taking place, you know, at the time when Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur started their preaching missions. You know, this was the state of the of affairs. So they had a lot of house cleaning to do. So, you know, what I thought that I would focus on today is a really, it's not such a commonly referenced verse and purport, but it says a tremendous amount about the process that Srila Prabhupada's given us. And this is just before the very famous Yenye Ravandaksha Vimukti Mani Nas verse, you know, in the second chapter of the 10th canto, which describes, you know, how this is the prayers of the demigods to Lord Krishna within the womb. And so this Yenye Ravandaksha Vimukti Maninas Tvayashtad Bhavarava Shuddha Buddhaya. You know, this is the verse where one imagines he's liberated, but because he's failed to achieve attachment for the Lord, to the Lord, you know, he falls down from his position of imagined superiority. So just prior to that is a verse which is, from my estimation, very relevant to what we're, you know, what I kind of started to unpack here. You know, how we actually become qualified to go back to Godhead, how we actually become qualified to enter into the pastimes of the Lord and, you know, understand our sarup. And so anyway, let me, you know, this is why I didn't chant much Jai Radha Madhava and why we didn't chant the Sanskrit responsively. So this is Bhagavatam 10, canto, second chapter, 31st verse. Now, I'll read the translation, just some of the purport. This is, I want to give an example of someone that achieved this very high level of Krishna consciousness by following this formula that Prabhupada unpacks in this verse and purport. O Lord, who resemble the shining sun, you are always ready to fulfill the desire of your devotee. And therefore, you are known as a desire tree, Panchakalpa Taru. When acharyas completely take shelter under your lotus feet, in order to cross the fierce ocean of nescience, they leave behind on earth the method by which they cross, and you are very merciful to your other devotees. You accept this method to help them. Okay, so purport. This statement reveals how the merciful acharyas and the merciful Supreme Personality of Godhead together help the serious devotee who wants to return home back to Godhead. I'm skipping a little bit here. The duty of the guru is to find the means according to the time, the circumstances, and the candidate by which one can be induced to render devotional service, which Krishna accepts from the candidate who wants to be successful in going back home, back to Godhead. Rupa Goswami After wandering throughout the universe, a fortunate person within this material world seeks shelter of such a guru or acharya, who trains the devotee in the suitable ways to render service according to the circumstances, so that the Supreme Personality of Godhead will accept the service. This makes it easier for the candidate to reach the ultimate destination. The acharya's duty, therefore, is to find the means by which devotees can render service according to references from Shastra. Okay, so then, so there's, starting with Srila Vyasadeva, he made substantial adjustments to facilitate people in Kali Yuga to take up Krishna consciousness. He divided the Vedas, one Veda, into four. So it's something that every acharya does. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur made very substantial adjustments. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur introduced sannyas. That wasn't done before in our tradition. What to speak of Srila Prabhupada? He created the Brahmacharini Ashram. He accepted Guru Puja when the deities were open. He did many, many adjustments. And, he reduced the number of rounds of japa from 64 to 16. Actually, there's an interesting point in that regard. Krishna, what's the name of this devotee? He finished his PhD from Sweden, and he did a biography of Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. I'm drawing a blank here. Anyway, he said that the preachers in the Gaudiya Math, they would chant 16 rounds a day. And those that went out, this was the research that he found, and those that stayed back, in the temple worship, they would chant 64 rounds a day. So the adjustment that Prabhupada made, there was already a precedent for that. So Prabhupada made many adjustments, but he had core instructions, 16 rounds for regulative principles. And another point that came up in a discussion, and it was repeated in numerous occasions, according to Hari Sariprabhu, was like in the beginning days of the Juhu Project, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, Prabhupada leaned heavily upon him. We just heard a glorification of Shesha made of Tamal Krishna Maharaj on his, was it his Vyasa Puja last Sunday? And so Prabhupada, he couldn't find anyone else to handle the degree of difficulty of getting the Juhu project up and running, except Tamal Krishna Maharaj. And one day Tamal Krishna Maharaj exclaimed to Prabhupada, "What hope is there? How can I think of Krishna? My mind is simply filled with temple finances." And Prabhupada responded by saying, "Yes, we've wasted many lifetimes on ourselves. If just in this one lifetime, we can dedicate heart and soul to pushing on Lord Chaitanya's movement, then at the end, even if we're not completely perfect, Lord Chaitanya will personally come, he'll cover what we lack, and personally take us back to Godhead." So this was I actually found this. Bhakti Vikas Swami always was posting these messages on the Prabhupada Said conference. And I asked him where he got it, and he said he was listening to a lecture that Tamal Krishna Maharaj gave, and he just kind of transcribed it from that. So, the reason I'm bringing this up is that there, of course, there's the traditional path that's given by Rupa Goswami and Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where a sadhaka comes to a point, he's achieved nishtha, he's pretty much free, the nartha nivritti, and there's no major issues going on in his behavior and his ability to follow devotional principles. And you know, and he's been focusing on the Bhagavatam for a long time, you know, and he's, but the loba, or this intense greed, you know, to follow in the footsteps of a resident of Vrindavan hasn't awoken yet. And, you know, that's not so common, actually. But it's a big part of our tradition. So then, how does that person go back to Godhead? So this question is actually answered, you know, in this verse in purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Acharya gives the suitable method for crossing the ocean of nations by accepting the boat of the lotus feet of the Lord. And if this method is strictly followed, the followers will ultimately reach the destination by the grace of the Lord. So, I saw, you know, I was close friends with one devotee. Some of you may know him. This is Nirguna Prabhu. And he was a Prabhupada disciple. And I first met him in 1988. I distributed books with him in the Smoky Mountain National Park. And, you know, he was a super enthusiastic book distributor. Mahatma Mataji introduced me to a devotee. What was the name of the devotee that you introduced me to over here? Brajabalaba. The other day. And he knew Nirguna, and he said exactly what I said about Nirguna. Any opportunity that he had to distribute books, he would just jump at it with full enthusiasm. I remember I used to go to the Atlanta airport with him to distribute, and it would be, you know, a tough place, you know. I mean, you really got to grind it out. You know, some of these businessmen were really hard to induce them to take a book. So we would work hard all day, and, you know, maybe 6-7 hours in the airport. And then it was about a 45-minute to an hour ride back to the temple. Maybe we would stop at a gas station to fill the tank. And everybody else would be in the van, you know, just kind of like zonked out, you know, from a real hard day of Sankirtan. But Nirguna would just jump out, and he would start, you know, hitting people up, you know, waiting, you know, to get gas, or he'd approach the gas station attendants. That was the kind of person he was. So we were partners actually for 18 years. We did book distribution together, and then when I moved to India, you know, I kind of had to resort to the pit because the cost of living, you know, just the expenses, you know, and starting the Mayapur Institute just wasn't possible just through book distribution. So then we'd do the pit together. But he was just a bundle of determination and enthusiasm. Actually, Prabhupada, this is something that came from Giriraj Swami, he defined on numerous occasions, according to Giriraj Swami, determination. It's a determination to go back to Godhead in this very lifetime. And so they're going to, like, really epitomize this type of determination. But, you know, he wasn't known as, you know, as a super advanced world preacher, like super advanced, but he's just a real strict sadhaka and very sincere in his service. And my wife and I had the good fortune of assisting him in the last 3 months of his life. You know, he had he developed terminal cancer. He had a huge tumor in his chest. And he came to India. I mean, he'd been 7 years ago, Gorpani Festival, he'd come to participate in the festival. Somehow or other, I was in Vrindavan at the time. We missed each other by one day on each side. But then I got word from a devotee that we used to distribute books with that he was really sick. And so then I tracked him down, and he'd already come to India. He'd spent $5,000 in Atlanta to try and get a diagnosis, and he still didn't really have a conclusive diagnosis of what was wrong. So he got, you know, the mercy of the Bhaktivedanta Hospital, and they put him in the front of the queue at the Tata Memorial Hospital in Bombay, which is the number one cancer hospital in Western India. And So, you know, I was talking to him on the phone, and he knew that it was heavy. They didn't specifically spell it out what was going on. But then I talked with Vaishnava Seva, and he said he had spindle cell sarcoma, you know, like a 6-inch, no, it was like 3.5-inch by 2.5-inch tumor that enveloped his aorta, you know, the main artery into the heart, and his bronchial tube and his esophagus, you know, so it wasn't operable. It was in such a vital place. So anyway, I've got to fast forward this. This is like a pretty intriguing story, you know, of how he just made incredible progress, you know, over a period of 3 months, you know, how he got increasingly purified to the point where in the presence of, and maybe I should tell some of the details because it's pretty amazing. It's actually quite miraculous, you know, his departure past then. I guess this is about 6 weeks before he left. This is on Radhastami. I got a call from my wife. I was in Vrindavan. I was teaching nectar devotion. I got a call from my wife, and she told me that I should immediately come back to Mayapur, and because otherwise I wouldn't see Nirguna again. He had come to a decision that he was just going to stop taking any. He'd already stopped taking any solid food because he just couldn't swallow it because of the constriction of the tumor. He was going to stop taking liquids. And when you stop that, you've got, like, I think it's 3.5 days, you know, and then the whole body starts shutting down. So he was going to stop doing that. So I immediately booked a flight and came back. And on the flight, I was reading Banaswami's translation and of the Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu in the commentaries. I was looking at the commentaries and how the desire for liberation and artificial renunciation actually harden the heart and are contrary, you know, kind of make bhakti much more difficult. So when I got to him, you know, we started talking, and I just started thinking, you know, because he was in a lot of pain, and that was, you know, it's kind of like a desire for liberation. You know, he wanted to get out of the whole scene. And, you know, he'd found a reference in the seventh canto, where this is legitimate. If the body is no longer functional, then just like Maharaj Pariksit, you know, he fasted until death. So, and he consulted with Jnanivas, and Jnanivas gave him a green light. But then I said to him, you know, actually, Krishna may have a lot more learning, you know, for you to go through, a lot more growth. So, and it does seem like this may be contrary to bhakti, you know, that you want out because it's so painful. And, you know, but this is also part of the process, you know, to go through the distresses that Krishna sends our way, you know, to purify us. So then he started crying. He said, no, it's too much pain, you know. And so I just left. And then later in the, you know, about 4 or 5 hours later, I came back to him. And he said, Samasam, I've been thinking about this, and you know you're right. Can I have a glass of water? You know, and so then he resumed. This was like 6 weeks before he actually left. And when, I just had this intuition in my heart that this was something that would be extremely valuable to him, to just stick it out. And so I pretty much, you know, I was actually just about to present the chapter on Raganuga Bhakti and Bhava Bhakti and Prema Bhakti in Vrindavan, so I went back to finish off the course. And then I came back, and, you know, his condition had worsened quite a bit. He'd actually had to go for emergency treatment in Krishnanagar, and we realized that we didn't have adequately staffing to handle his medical needs. So we, you know, I'd been Sankirtan in America for, like, since I joined up until I became temple president in 1992. So for 14 years I'd been Sankirtan leader. But this was the biggest marathon I'd ever organized, you know, for to facilitate Nirguna's departure. And we actually ended up having, you know, one of the things that happened as the cancer progressed, the cancer ate into his spinal cord, and he became paralyzed from the waist down. And with that paralysis came this very intense pain, you know, in his legs and feet. And we discovered that the only way that he would get any kind of relief from it was to have vigorous and constant massage by devotees of his feet and legs. So I started making announcements after Mangalartik, and we actually ended up having 32 caregivers to go on, you know, continuous 24/7 massage. Because even if he was asleep and the massage wasn't going on, he would wake up in excruciating pain, which would take hours to reduce, you know, through the massage. So it was actually an excellent facility for devotees to serve another devotee and to get to know Nirguna. I mean, Harisari didn't even know him before, and they became very, very close. Harisari would come every day, and he'd read for an hour or an hour and a half from his unpublished diary. So about 10 days before his departure, I got different versions. I sometimes tell this story, and it takes 2 hours to unpack, you know, so now I'm doing it in about 15 minutes. I'm doing the 15-minute version. But about 10 days before he left, he revealed to one of the... We had physical caregivers, and we also had spiritual caregivers. We had one of the devotees from the Bhaktivedanta Hospital that was just finishing up his training in hospice care. So he came. And then, you know, we had my wife, she was a nurse before she became a devotee. And then we had another, Rapa Devi, Prabhupada disciple from the UK, she's a nurse. So we had quite a few on the care team. So we had spiritual caregivers, you know, like the senior devotees who come and read to Nirguna. And then we had those devotees that were doing the massage and other real practical things. So one day, Nirguna revealed to the devotee that, you know, somehow or other, I have this understanding that my service in Vrindavan is that of a manjari, you know, of facilitating Radha Krishna's conjugal pastimes. But I'm not sure of it, and I'm waiting for an invitation. Okay, so he explained it, you know, and here he is, you know, he hadn't really eaten, he was a small man anyway. But he hadn't eaten practically for, you know, like 6-7 weeks. So his thigh was the size of my wrist, you know, and he was just, he got down, so he was, I think he weighed 45 pounds at the end, you know. And he I think when he was in normal health, he weighed, I think, about 115 or 120. So, you know, he was just kind of a bag of bones. And, you know, and then this became a subject matter of discussion between himself and Harisari. You know, and the way it went was that in order to hear Nirguna, because he was so weak, you'd had to put your ear right on his mouth and he'd whisper to you. Okay, so so from time to time, Harisari would say, Nirguna Prabhu, have you gotten your invitation yet? And Nirguna would kind of like in a dejected way say, no, hang his head. He's just like, just kind of meditating on it. He had this impression. It wasn't actually a vision, but it was just some kind of an inner sense that this was his swarup. So then, one night, you know, what I would do, you know, to kind of facilitate his support, I would contact senior devotees that he had developed relationships with over the years. So, one senior devotee that he was close with was Jayapataka Swami, because he'd married Jayapataka Swami's disciple, and he'd served as the temple president in Murari Sevak. Jayapataka Swami was the GBC. So this was the night that this took place. This was on the appearance day of Radha Kund, So I had located Jayapataka Swami. He was in Southern California. And I went to Nirguna. It was about 10 minutes after 9 at night. And I said to Nirguna, you know, Grahila Prabhu, who used to be an indexer for the BBT, he was on duty. You know, he was massaging Nirguna's legs at the time. We'd had, most of the devotees had gone home. Every night we'd have kirtan. We had multiple kirtans. We'd have all the Gurukul boys, they would come. They would do kirtan. And then the Gurukul girls would come. And then the adults would come. And we'd end up about 8:30 at night. So this is 9:10. And practically everybody had gone home. So I told Nirguna Prabhu, I got Jayapataka Swami on the in 5 minutes. He'll call you. And I was kind of shocked at his response. He pushed me away like I was bugging him. He was very weak, but, you know, it was just kind of like... So then I went to Grahil and said, Grahil, what's going on with Nirguna? And he said, I don't know, Jamanasmi, but I got a real strong sense he's about ready to leave his body. So then I went and woke up. Now he's in charge of the hospice in Vrindavan. I can't think of what his name is. This is what happens when you get a 64-year-old brain. Huh? Avnish. But now he's initiated. He's got another name. I told Avnish what Grahila told me. And he said, okay, let me check. And sure enough, you know, he went and checked his pulse and his blood pressure, and it was very, very low. He couldn't actually perceive blood pressure. It wasn't detectable. It was so low. And he said, okay, so, because we would ask him for different predictions of how long Nirguna would live. And, you know, up until then he'd say, you know, he'll live like 1 to 2 weeks, you know, then he'll live a few days. And after getting that, you know, checking his vital signs, he said he's got, you know, just a few hours left. So then I called everybody back. You know, Hari Sari had just taken a rest. I called him, Pankajangri Janani Vasa. We started all night kirtan. And then after Mangal Arti, Karma Prabhu, the famous cook, was there. And he led kirtan for 7 hours throughout the night. They became friends because Nirguna's wife, 2 years prior to his departure, left him. You know, she kind of like got covered over. And that was also one of the arguments I used to Nirguna to not fast until death, because his ex-wife was coming to see him. They said, you got this responsibility, Guru Nisashat, Swajano Nisashat. So anyway, she actually started practicing Krishna consciousness again. Okay, so I digress a little bit. The clock's killing me on this. So we're getting to the punchline, so don't leave yet. You know, it's pretty amazing. So then, the kirtan, you know, so I went to, after Mangal Arti, I described the situation that Nirguna lost consciousness. Dr. Avnish, he didn't feel that he would regain it. I quoted Radhanath Swami, who had experience, you know, with Bhakti Tirtha Swami and a couple of his disciples assisting their departure. He said it's very important that the chanting of the holy name is going on because the soul is very conscious of this and it will really help, you know. So this was in the first Mayapur Institute classroom. It was actually my first apartment. And we'd taken the veranda wall out and turned it into a classroom. So it was a small space, 16 by 20 feet. And we had about 75 to 80 devotees in there, you know, after everybody came over from Mangal Arti. And it was really powerful kirtan going on. And then there one devotee from Vancouver, Madan Mohan, he started leading the kirtan. He was on the Nagar, the Nagar Sankirtan department. He had this real beautiful singing voice. So he was leading the kirtan. And at about 7:20 in the morning, Bhakti Vishwambar Madhava Swami, who was just here, sannyasi, you know, he'd taken a month off just to assist Nirguna's departure. So he was sitting right next to me. We had Nirguna kind of pointed like in a rocket ship. We had this hospital bed, and it was pointed in right into the due east, because that was the most auspicious position. The vastu in the house was a little out of whack, so it was right into this corner. So Bhakti Vishwambar Madhava Swami was sitting right near Nirguna's head. Across on the other side of the bed was Hari Sari, Janani Vas, Pankajangri, Padmalochan. I was sitting right next to Bhakti Vishwamba Madhava Swami. And then all of a sudden, Maharaj scared the hell out of me. He grabbed my leg and said, Jamastami, Jamastami, look, Nirguna, his mouth is moving. And so I looked and said, sure enough, you know. And not only that, but it became evident that he was singing along with a kirtan. You know, and then he opened, you know, then he opens his eyes and he lifts his arms up and he's got an incredibly blissed out look on his face. And here, you know, he couldn't even lift his finger, you know, like 12 hours before. But here he's lifting his arms up and he's chanting along and completely blissed out. And Dr. Avnish said he'd never, ever seen anything like this. This completely defied any understanding he had of the dying process. So in the course, and of course the kirtan just escalated to a whole new crescendo of ecstasy. It was like amazing. And in the midst of this kirtan, you know, Hari Sari, who'd had this dialogue going on with Nirguna, heard Nirguna speak in a loud voice, you know, in the midst of the kirtan, get your peace and go. So Hari Sari was like completely bewildered by this. You know, first of all, that it was coming in such a loud voice. So then he went to Nirguna and he said, Nirguna, did someone say something to you? And Nirguna shook his head. I mean, he's completely in ecstasy. And then Hari Sari said, so who? And he said, Giriraj. And it was speaking in a normal voice. It wasn't a whisper anymore. So then Hari Sari said, Hari Sari was thinking to himself that, he said, peace, well, get your peace of mind and go. So then, but he wasn't quite sure. So then Hari Sari said, what did Giriraj mean by peace? And he said, Giriraj. So Hari Sari said, he kind of started putting it all together. So Giriraj, oh, by the way, this is part of the miracle. Ramadevi, who was an attending nurse, you have to forgive me if I run over time a little bit. It's just too much ecstasy for me to try and contain it all. She was worshiping Govardhan Srila. The first BBT painting that Nirguna saw of Krishna was of Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill. So he had a very special bhav with Giriraj. So towards the end, like the last 10 days or so, devotees put a Giriraj on his chest, you know, so he was looking, and when he looked straight ahead, you know, he'd see these big white eyes beaming back at him. And then, you know, the last couple of days, Hari Sari put a Giriraj right in his right hand. So then Hari Sari said to Nirguna, so Giriraj told you to take him and go. And then Nirguna shook his head like that. So, and then he said to Nirguna, Prabhu, did you get your invitation? And then Nirguna just beamed and he said, yes. You know, so then, you know, what I did after that, I didn't know all that was going on because I was managing this whole affair, you know. It was like this huge marathon. I had, you know, I slept like 1 hour that night and I knew I had to deal with the government officials in Krishnanagar so we could have the cremation, you know, in a timely way. And so at any rate, you know, I got Radhana Swami on the phone and, you know, he'd coached me through the whole thing. And then, so he started talking to Nirguna, you know, preaching to him a little bit. And he just started singing some Vaishnava bhajans and then just started chanting japa. And so went on for about a half an hour, and I was thinking, you know, here in India, you know, there's always these disconnects on mobile phones. So I picked up the headset, you know, from the mobile phone, put it on my ear and said, Maharaj, are you still there? And I said, yes, Jim asked me, but I got to go. I'm going to miss my plane. Because he was coming for this Mayapur Yatra with like 4,000 or 5,000 of his disciples, you know, that was supposed to have to start the next day. I was hoping that Nirguna would hold on until then, you know, Krishna had another plan. So at any rate, then shortly after that, Nirguna lost consciousness. And then at 1:22 in that afternoon, he left his body. And You know, it was just like the most amazing thing. You know, there's a term in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rati Abhas, where when you're in the presence of someone who's on the bhava platform, you experience that same ecstasy. And there's examples of devotees that were in Prabhupada's association where he would be in this ecstatic, you know, state, and they would just feel this incredible ecstasy. So everybody that was in that room felt like amazing transcendental bliss at that time. So I guess the point is this, you know, Prabhupada gave us a promise that if we simply chant 16 rounds, follow the regulative principles, and dedicate our lives to pushing this movement on, then at the end, even if we're not completely perfect, Krishna will come, or Chaitanya will personally come, recover what we lack, and personally take us back to Godhead. So this is a case in point. And, you know, I actually, you know, in this book that Giriraj Swami just published, Death and Dying from a Vedic Perspective. You know, I told this story at the opening of the, I did the half-hour version, you know, the opening of the Vrindavan Hospice. And so they transcribed it and put it in there. But it's not, you know, one of the points that Giriraj Swami makes is that this isn't unique. This has happened with a lot of devotees. You know, in their last moments, they come to a very, very high level of Krishna consciousness. If one realizes this sarup, you know, that's symptomatic of the stage of bhava. And so, and there's a promise, just like, you know, Bhishma Dev, you know, in the battle of Kurukshetra, in the early part of the battle, Duryodhana came to him and complained, "You're not really fighting up to your capacity because of your affection for the Pandavas." So, that was a big, you know, insult, you know, to a Kshatriya chivalry. So Bhishma Dev made a vow, you know, that he would either force Krishna to break his vow, and Krishna at the beginning of the battle had made a vow that he would, you know, his army would go on one side and he'd go on the other side, but he wouldn't personally fight. So he made a vow that he wouldn't fight. So then, so Bhishma Dev made this vow. He'd either kill Arjuna or he'd force Krishna to break his vow. So the next day in the battle, sure enough, you know, Arjuna is in a really precarious position, and it looks like Bhishma Dev is about ready to kill him. So what does Krishna do? To preserve the promise or the vow of his devotee, he breaks his own vow because it has a higher priority. So he jumps off the chariot, you know, gets the broken chariot wheel and goes after Bhishma Dev, you know, so Bhishma Dev vow is not broken. So this is kind of the transcendental teamwork that takes place between Krishna and the Acharya. The Acharya establishes the means for his followers. He leaves the boat on the shore of the ocean of nations so that the devotee can cross over it very easily. Samashita ye para palava pavam mahatpadam punya yasho marare pavam budir vatsapadam param padam 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 yat vi padam natesham. It's like being able to cross the water that's contained in a hoof print of a calf, you know, it becomes so easy. And so this is, you know, for one who takes shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. And that taking shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord is working under the direction of the Acharya. You know, he gives specific, according to time, circumstances, and the candidates, directions of how he can cross over. So this is very clear, and Prabhupada repetitively made these statements. So if we take that up, we don't need anything else. There's no greener pasture. We've got the most empowered acharya in the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, you know, as our foundational Shiksha Guru. So let me stop here. Sometimes the class goes to 9, I notice. So if there's any questions or comments or chastisements, I'll try my best. Sorry if I went so long. It's hard to compress into a short period. Anything? Thank you. Yes, Mataji. I'm sorry, I don't know everybody. I know a lot of faces, but I've been out of America for about 17 years. So, Can't remember everybody's names. Yes.
I actually appreciated your class so much and this story so much, because to me also it's very clear that what Srila Prabhupada gave us was more than sufficient. And then these stories when devotees pass, just, you know, following Prabhupada's instructions, you know, trying to spread the movement, distribute his books, and they're elevated to the highest platform. So it's not that we have to be to do something else, you know, to find some other literatures to read. It's like everything's there. So anyway, thank you very much. I thought it was very confirming again.
I found a lot of Shastric support for also what Prabhupada has said, you know, from Jiva Goswami's Bhakti Sandarbha, also Prabhupada Saraswati Thakur, you know, in Chaitanya Chandamrita. You know, he describes how that one who gets the nectar of service to Lord Chaitanya, he's the one that can taste the nectar of service to Radha and Krishna. That's how it takes place. In Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in Navadvip Dham Mahatmya, he describes that this Dasya Ras to Lord Chaitanya naturally transforms into the Braj Bhakti, you know, as one progresses. So this is like the whole mood of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada. And, you know, we've got many, many examples, and we'll have many more, you know, of how this actually manifests. Now, it's not to say that some devotees, you know, that awaken greed, loba, you know, they practice, they don't manifest this externally, but they can go ahead, they go ahead. You know, this is a big part of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. You can practice Raganuga Bhakti. But, you know, there's another interesting point, you know, that Jiva Goswami makes in Bhakti Sandarbha, and that's that, you know, there's Ajata Ruchi and Jata Ruchi Raganuga Bhakti. So actually, because the sadhana practices that Prabhupada has given us, you know, the Pancharatriki, Bhagavat Vidhi, you know, in different places, like for instance in a lecture on Bhagavatam 4.24.45 in Kharagpur, Prabhupada, you know, the Bhagavat Vidhi is actually the Bhakti Mark. So there's bhakti matra kama. So bhakti that's focused, you know, the devotional practices that are focused to develop pure devotion, to enter into the braj bhakti, you know, this is actually an important aspect of the Raganuga bhakti process. And so there's two levels of Raganuga Bhakti, according to Jiva Goswami in Bhakti Sandarbha. There's Ajata Ruchi. This is before taste awakens, before greed awakens. And then there's Jata Ruchi, where the taste is awoken, where the greed's there. But it's a flow, you know, it's a continuum. So, in that sense, one could say that a serious ISKCON sadhaka, he's actually practicing Raganuga Bhakti. Because that's the end result, you know. But it's in a particular mood that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur and Srila Prabhupada had. You know, according to the requirements of a worldwide mission, and according to the time, the circumstances, and the candidates. Hey, we weren't born in so auspicious conditions, you know, here in America, right? You know, so we got a ways to go, so that we need the power, you know, such a powerful yuga dharma to get there. Anything else, or shall we end? Yes, Mahatma Mataji.
Hare Krishna. In 1995, the mailman from LA moved to Alachua After serving the devotees there for 17 years, and I think it was kind of the first case that we saw here in Alacha, I was able to take care of him.
You took care of him?
Yeah, for about 3 months, because as soon as he moved here, he was diagnosed with a terminal illness, so he only lasted 3 months. But I was going to say that the mercy from Lord Chaitanya and Srila Prabhupada go beyond the rules and the regulations, because he was serving the devotees for 17 years, but he never went into the temple because he didn't want to take his shoes off in L.A. until Janmashtami day that year. And then I invited him to come here, so he came. So short story, but... So when he was diagnosed, he had not been chanting for years or whatever. He just heard everything, but he never chanted. So at the time that he was diagnosed, you know, I was honored to take care of him. And I told him, this is it. You know, you have to listen and you have to see. So I had all these videos running for him every day, and he was listening. And devotees will come and ask him, what are you thinking? What are your desires? And he says, well, I want to eat this, I want to eat that. But Mahatma says I shouldn't, because at the time of death, I have to be clean mind and my body also. So he followed, like, for a few weeks or a few months, you know, austerities and listen. And I tell you, Prabhu, his departure was very auspicious. And this is just to say that Lord Chaitanya's mercy goes beyond, you know. I mean, yes, we have to follow, but at the end, Krishna will favor these souls that have a little bit of sincerity or a little bit of desire to get close. He just accepted that because I say so. He said, I have to. And when the Jehovah Witnesses came and asked him, are you afraid of dying? And he says, no, I'm not, because Mahatma says that I'm going to come back as a Japanese devotee, and I'm going to be able to jump and dance in my next life in the temple.
Okay. Thank you for putting us in ecstasy, Mataji. Very nice. So it's a pastime that's repetitively performed by Lord Chaitanya. And so we can have full confidence that just by taking shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord, by following Srila Prabhupada's directions, that this will be our destiny as well. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.